This is WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The United States emerged from the Cold War as the world's towering military power. But can all that power force the world to peace? Author Jonathan Schell thinks not. Tonight, On Point, Jonathan Schell and the unconquerable world. But first, we begin with a Republican dust-up over tax cuts in Washington. President Bush's big tax cut package took heat for not sharing the cuts with low-income families. Now, the GOP-controlled Congress and White House are fighting over the right fix. I spoke with Juliet Eilprin, staff writer for The Washington Post, and asked her what's behind the Republican leadership split.
They're embroiled in a bit of a controversy because they passed a $350 billion tax cut just before leaving for the Memorial Day recess. And in the process of drafting that tax cut, they left out 6.5 million poor families that ordinarily would have gotten a larger child tax credit.
These are families making between $10,000 and $26,000, roughly.
Exactly. Those families would not get, they would get $600 rather than $1,000, which middle-class families would get. So once this was exposed and liberal interest groups started touting this, the Republicans felt under pressure to do something to correct this so
because
that they didn't appear insensitive.
It made them look more than ever like they were giving tax breaks to the rich and not to the poor.
That was their concern.
But, of course, these people don't pay taxes. They get tax credits.
Right, and that was part of the problem because Republicans in the House are philosophically opposed to that. They argue these people aren't paying taxes. Why should we give them money? That makes no sense.
So now where are the White House, the House, and Senate coming down?
In different places. Essentially, the Senate passed a measure last week that would allow these families to receive the child tax credit, although it would do a few other things. It would allow families earning up to $150,000, for example, instead of $110,000 to qualify for this tax credit. Essentially, what the House did is that they've come up with a much broader proposal. The Senate proposal, for example, cost $10 billion. The House bill costs $82 billion, and it would include not only this tax credit in the way I've described it, they would actually do it all the way up to 2010 instead of for a shorter period of time.
For low-income working families.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But they would also add in a number of benefits for military families unrelated to this child tax credit and money that would go to the families of astronauts who died in space shuttle missions.
Juliet, I'm confused then about the philosophical position here. I thought that the House wanted to not see deficit spending, and of course there's a $400 billion deficit projected by the Congressional Budget Office, a record. But I thought the House was resisting pressure from the White House to fix up this political vulnerability because they didn't want that deficit. Have I got that wrong?
Well, you know, their argument is that they still have billions they can spend on tax relief. They consider that a totally different category than spending. And so their position is, look, if you liberals want a tax credit for children, that's fine, but we're going to use it as an opportunity to pass some of our priorities. So that's really how they get around that issue.
So it's going even further into the tax relief camp and deficits be damned?
Exactly. Basically, the argument is, you know, sure, the Senate wanted to stop at $350, for example. The House wanted to spend $550 billion in tax relief. And so they're saying, we'll go ahead. We don't worry about the implications of this for the deficit. They think that getting more money into the hands of Americans ultimately will generate jobs and eliminate the deficit.
And when the House felt pressure from the White House to go along with the Senate's less expensive bill, the response, as you reported, was pretty crisp. Tom DeLay said, ain't going to happen.
Exactly. Basically, they're not that concerned. Now, I think one of the real questions is, how aggressively is the White House pushing for example, the Senate proposal? I think the White House has given some indications that they're willing to have other proposals, but they simply want to see this child tax credit problem fixed before it becomes a liability for the president.
So, in practical terms, in all likelihood, it sounds as though the child tax credit problem, as it were, will be fixed, that they will share, it looks now, in that larger exemption.
True, although there's one caveat I would put, which is that given that the House is going to pass this very broad, very expensive bill, there's some chance that it will get bogged down in negotiations between the House and Senate because there are many senators, including some moderate Republicans, who simply aren't willing to go above that $350 billion figure that they just approved. They accepted this $10 billion fix because it was offset by an increase in custom fees and therefore didn't add a penny to the deficit.
So, Juliet, how would you describe the fundamental kind of political conflict here behind the numbers?
Well, you know, I would say that, again, it's a philosophical fight over who deserves tax cuts. And there's a real difference between the House and Senate on this, and I think it just simply highlights, again, the roles that these two chambers are playing, whereas the Senate is a curb on what the House is doing and the White House is trying to straddle the middle ground.
And the philosophical difference being the House says we want to put tax money back in the pockets of whom compared to the Senate?
Well, tax money in the pocket of, for many cases, middle-class Americans and corporations who they think, and small businesses who they think do a better job of generating economic growth than low-income Americans. If you look at all their tax packages, they describe them as growth packages rather than, say, just simply relief for American families.
And the political message in the Senate's plan?
The political message in the Senate's plan is we care about poor people. We care about working families, even if they don't pay taxes, because they do, of course, pay things like payroll taxes. And we want to take care of everyone, have everyone included in any kind of tax measure that we're doing.
Well, we'll be watching. Juliet Alperin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Juliet Alperin is staff writer for The Washington Post. She spoke with us earlier from Washington. The American military, 2003, has been tasked with world domination. No power, according to Bush doctrine, will be allowed to rise to challenge the United States. The implication, peace will be kept by the gun. Our guest tonight, acclaimed writer and thinker and one-time war correspondent Jonathan Schell, says it won't work. Never has, never will. Every empire has learned, he says, the world cannot be conquered. But there are other forces that may promise peace and support American freedoms, forces like you. So who is the dreamer and who is the realist today? Can, must a superpower enforce peace? Did the 20th century prove the power of force or the power of people over force? And what will you bet on now? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Jonathan Schell, peace and disarmament editor for The Nation magazine and author of The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. Good evening and welcome, Jonathan Schell.
Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Jonathan.
Hello, Jack. How are you?
Fine. Nice to have you on the program.
So great.
Jonathan Schell, you deliver another big book right into the midst of history here with a lot for us to take on board and right into the teeth of the big momentum out of Washington, which is toward a military that spans the globe and is ready to go anywhere, anytime, guns blazing, to keep the peace, to fight terror. You say that ultimately this won't work. We're going to look at your case in detail tonight, Jonathan, but give it to us in its condensed form. What are you telling us?
Well, I'll just to answer that question. The history of the 20th century has delivered a pretty clear verdict on imperial ambitions. Every empire that was standing at the beginning of the 20th century had fallen by its end. There's something in this world that does not love an empire, whether we're speaking of the Soviet Empire, the British, the Portuguese, what have you. And to me, well, the remarkable thing about this is that it was done with either inferior force by those resisting or by no force whatsoever. And
examples of that being?
Well, think of the Soviet Union. There's never been a greater or more fearsome or better armed empire than that one, with its nuclear weapons, its Red Army, the KGB, all the other security services just penetrating every crevice of society. And yet, one fine morning, the whole thing melted away like a bad dream, like the morning dew. What really did it, I think, was a change in the hearts and minds of the people under that rule. I mean, I'd point to the Solidarity movement in Poland, for example. you know, Lech Wałęsa made a beautiful boat there. He said that we did it without breaking a single pane of glass. So if you want to talk about what's real and what isn't, the collapse of the Soviet Union is a pretty real thing. Where is it now?
Jonathan Schell, I'm having a little trouble with your microphone. I can't quite make you out there, but I hear you on the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Of course, the argument made on the other side of that, and that Bush supporters might make today, is that the Soviet Union was made ripe for the falling by the relentless pressure of the Reagan administration, which kept the heat on in the arms race to such an extent that the Soviets couldn't compete, and it more or less fell into the laps of the Soviet people.
You know, there's a grain of truth in that. It's about 5% of the truth, or maybe 3% of the truth. But the plain facts of history, if you look at that, is that the Soviet Union fell because of an immense internal convulsion, rebellion against it in Eastern Europe and then in Russia, and then subsequently launching perestroika movement by Gorbachev. I think that where the military competition of the United States came into play was that it was one more sort of crushing illustration of their technical and economic backwardness. I do think that the Reagan buildup rubbed in that lesson. They just saw that they weren't going to be able to keep up, as indeed no nation has been able to keep up since the fall of the Soviet Union.
So we've been talking a lot about U.S. military strategy post-9/11, during Iraq, post-Iraq, about the outposts that we're going to be planting around the world according to new strategic plans now. When you look at the Bush administration's military plans, military outlook, its outlook in general at global security, What comes to mind, Jonathan Schell, now?
Well, let's take a look at what we're doing right now in Iraq. You know, there are a couple of reasons for going in there. One of them was to stop the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, not only in Iraq, but really in other countries, too. You remember the whole axis of evil.
Yes, we do.
Now, if you look at the results here, I mean, right in the foreground is the fact that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction as far as we know so far. That could change, but looks like they didn't have them. But I actually think that that's the big story of the moment, and rightly so, because if it's true that the evidence was fudged or faked or whatever it was, then we were taken into war by a swindle, and that's a very, very big deal.
But your bottom line is, and you titled your book The Unconquerable World, that no amount of military force, no matter how overwhelming, can nail down all the corners here, can ensure global peace.
Well, that's exactly right, because look at what the consequences were outside of Iraq with respect to this goal of ours, namely nonproliferation. The lesson that other countries were supposed to learn was, if you get weapons of mass destruction, you're going to get regime change, too, from us. And what they learned was an exactly opposite lesson, and I'm thinking of North Korea and Iran, and that is we don't care for regime change, so we'd better get nuclear weapons. And they both have proceeded down that path, and North Korea has reached the destination. You know, we've embarked on an enterprise that is really novel in all of history, and that is what is, I think, properly called a hegemonic or an imperial enterprise, whose ostensible goal, and to some extent I think real goal, is to stop is disarmament. It's a kind of a disarmament empire, and we propose to fight these disarmament wars.
Quite explicitly.
Quite explicitly. But that overlooks, in my opinion, what the real nature and cause of proliferation is, which is, after all, the spread of technology and knowledge. It's not something that can be stopped by military force, I don't think. It's like trying to machine gun a mist.
And yet, Jack Beatty, everybody wants to see global security, global peace, and there are real threats out there. So?
Yes, how do you deal with them? Well, you know, when I first read Jonathan's pieces in Harper's, it was right around the time that the statue of Saddam Hussein was coming down, and he was talking about the other superpower of international public opinion and the unconquerable world. And what I was feeling was that the United States was eminently conquerable, that this case, full of holes as it was, had sold us on a war, and that we were, because of September 11th, wedded psychically to a kind of a preemptive aggression. But now I'm not so sure, as I reread his essay, as the public polls show just the other day, that something like it's tied, whether people 48-48 on whether people approve this war or not.
This is Americans, never mind the rest of the world. We're going to come back and look at that public opinion piece. We're looking tonight at the limits of force and the pitfalls of empire with Jonathan Schell. Can the U.S., can any power ride force to world peace? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the limits of force and the pitfalls of empire with writer and thinker Jonathan Schell. His new book is The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. You can join the conversation. Can the United States, can any power, ride force to world peace? And what about it? Did the 20th century prove the power of force or the power of people over force? In a time of terror and war, what is the path to a less violent future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Schell, you make your case, and it's interesting because you make it first in what seem like quite practical terms. You're saying not necessarily that this is wrong, though we can feel that beneath your critique, but that this just doesn't work, and it's been proven again and again by empires all the way back to Rome, taking for the moment the idea that this is an empire. And I'm sure the Bush administration, if they were sitting here tonight, would object to that characterization. But is the proof so surely in the pudding? And do changes in technology not change the circumstances? Is it not possible for the 21st century to be different?
You know, if you look back at the history of empire, one of the characteristics of it from the start, I mean, really now I'm speaking of the modern period, was the incredible disparity in technical and military power between the imperial master and the colonized or imperialized people. And the amazing invention, really, of many peoples in many different forms was to find a kind of power, a kind of resistance that could actually overmatch that technical superiority without equaling it in a technical sense. And what they really discovered, to put it in a word, is the power of popular political resistance, which did not need to be violent. Sometimes it was violent, sometimes it wasn't, but it didn't have to be.
And that ultimately, and there you're pointing, you looked at the Soviet Union, you also write in the book about Gandhi in India, and then you draw a line right on through. But what are the examples that you would cite?
Well, I mean, Gandhi is a wonderful example because he probably had more than any other single person. He had more to do with the downfall of the greatest empire of his day, namely the British, the one on which the sun was supposed never to set. But in fact, I think that in many shapes and forms, and sometimes, as they say, allied with violence in the form of people's wars, local peoples were able to resist and actually throw out, as I say, all of the empires. You know,
Vietnam would be
a wonderful. I started off my writing career as a reporter in Vietnam, and what I saw there was the U.S. sort of winning battles, every battle every day, but lose the war. Now, how could that be? How could we win the battles, every battle, but lose the war? And the answer was politics. It was the hearts and minds of the people there. Oh. They didn't want us, and as soon as we pulled out, they did what they wanted to do anyway.
But you know, what I assume a Bush administration representative would say, look, we are in a tough world. We're facing real threats, threats that can blow up, you know, our cities, that can come right into our towns. We can't, you know, what is this alternative, Jonathan Schell, that you're suggesting, that we just sit around and jawbone at the UN? You know, that didn't work. League of Nations, well, that didn't work.
No.
Isn't the argument we've got to go out there and create a perimeter so this doesn't pour right into our laps?
Well, creating a perimeter is fine. One thing they ought to do, but they haven't done, is give some help and support to the first responders here in the United States, the firemen and the policemen. But they can't seem to find a nickel for that. But to answer your question more broadly, yes, it's a dangerous world. There are terrible things that can be done to the United States or other countries and have been done, and you need to defend yourself against it. But really, terrorism wasn't born on September 11th. It was born in a way for Americans then, but it's a pretty familiar thing to a lot of the world, and a lot of lessons have been learned. And one of them is that conventional military force is a very poor instrument for dealing with it. What seems to work is a combination of very patient and assiduous police work, which in this case would have to be international in character, involving a lot of cooperation, and on the other hand, over the very long run, unfortunately taking a long time, is political solutions which address the underlying causes and grievances that give rise to it in the first place.
So if that is not the path the country chooses, and at the moment it is not, as Jack points out, even the war in Iraq, well, now it's kind of 48-48 in support of that. But so far the Bush administration is pushing ahead quite briskly on another path. You say it won't work, but what about other consequences along the way? You warn of harm to the United States itself from this path, not just that it won't work abroad.
Well, you know, I like to say that in the Iraq War, the United States won Iraq and lost the world, and that both of those consequences are bad for the United States. Because if you win a country like Iraq, then you own it, you know, then it's yours. We're over there picking up the garbage. You know, we're deciding on the salaries, hiring the teachers. You know, we can't even manage these things here in New York. We're firing the teachers right now.
Well, for now, you might say U.S. forces are doing that, but the express goal is to build a democracy here where there was a tyranny before, a bloody tyranny that was killing its own people. Is that not an admirable goal?
Well, if we could judge actions by the goals, or more properly, the wishes of the people carrying them out, then almost every action would be a delightful and a thrilling success. You know, unfortunately, I saw the United States build democracy in Vietnam for about 12 years. It was a story we told ourselves that we were building democracy, but what we actually were doing there had nothing whatsoever to do with that, and it was honestly eyewash. You know, I think we got a glimpse of the truth of what's going on in Iraq when the commander of American forces there, one General McKiernan, said, you know, in Iraq, we have absolute power, absolute power. And that's the reality so far in Iraq. I'm sure they'd love to set up Switzerland on the Tigris there, but I just don't think it's in the cards.
So is the alternative then sitting back and, having a talking shop with Saddam Hussein's of the world, tolerating them for decades, hoping that their plans don't wash back onto American shores or the shores of any other peaceful neighbor?
No, that would not be it. What I would suggest is that we join together, that we rejoin the community of nations, starting with our traditional allies. I mean, look how radical this policy has been, and look how radical the consequences have been. We are alienated and estranged from our NATO allies. From Europe, from the main countries of Europe. This is something we haven't experienced in the United States since World War I. You know, it's a very radical concept. So we should join with them. We should join with the other countries of the world at NATO. We should find a common programs. And believe me, after September 11th, there was global common ground. There was tremendous sympathy for the United States. There was a great will to cooperate with us and to move ahead, perhaps a little less violently and a little less unilaterally, but to address the problem of terrorism, which does indeed threaten the whole world. But we threw that away. We threw it all away.
Jack Beatty, is that your reading of the path we're on? And do you see the alternative here that Jonathan Schell's describing?
That is my reading of the path we're on. This program has been, it seems to me, unsparing in talking about this in the last 2 years. So this is a path that we have said in advance was going to happen and has been happening. But I want to believe, and as I read Jonathan's article, I wanted to believe that there was this other superpower out there. World opinion, the unconquerable world, and that somehow this supranational force would conquer us, in effect. That is to say, disabuse us of our feelings about sovereignty, and perhaps even disabuse us of our sense that we were uniquely afflicted by terrorism and therefore uniquely privileged to strike out. But then I was remembering, well, where have people fought this before? And of course, 1914. In 1914, the world economy was just as integrated as it is today, different ways, of course. And there was in the world what there isn't today, an international movement, international socialism, that said, we brothers of labor hold hands across the borders. We don't know any borders. We're an international movement. And that all collapsed in August 1914. Frenchmen forgot about their professions of solidarity with Germans and took rifles because the appeal of the nation was so strong. Jonathan, what about that? How can we get beyond the nation, which has wrecked supranational dreams again and again?
Well, one comment I'd make is that there's been an immense structural change in international military affairs since 1914. Back in that day, there were four or five, depending on how you want to count, great powers, as they put it in those days. And they were ready and able to fight a devastating war against one another, with one side winning and the other losing, as we recall from history. Today, we have a radically different situation. In the first place, we have what we're pleased to call the sole superpower, the United States. And in a way, it's as if all the force that had once been distributed among many powers had been concentrated into this one sort of unbeatable military colossus, namely the United States. So we don't have the potential that we had in both First World War and Second World War of the kind of slugging match that will go on for 3 or 4 years, the world wars that were really the thing that summoned up those national passions that did indeed dissolve the socialist international and all other forms of human solidarity, frankly. Today, it's a very different situation, and I think it's a more promising one.
Why so, Jonathan Schell?
Well, for one thing, part of the problem of the war has been taken care of by a most unfortunate expedient, and that's the existence of nuclear weapons. In other words, you're just not going to be able to have the kind of war that we had twice in the 20th century, a world war in which people fight it out and one side wins and the other loses. You have mutual assured destruction. Now, we can go ahead and do that, but it has nothing to do with war. So
Are you so sure of that in India, in Pakistan? I mean, and nukes that aren't even related to nations anymore. And I also wonder about Jack Beatty wanting to get beyond sovereignty. Do you also see that as the way to go? Is that what we're talking about here? Is an alternative to empire is surrendered sovereignty?
Well, you know, it's not an all or nothing matter. I raise that idea in actually a slightly different context, which is the context of the many, many bitter, bitter struggles in the world where you, in effect, have two peoples either intermixed on one territory, as in the former Yugoslavia, or else each claiming the same piece of territory, like Israel and the Palestinians and the West Bank and so forth. And there, the formula of complete sovereignty for either party spells repression, if not ethnic cleansing, for the other. So it's a sovereignty is a formula for catastrophe in those situations. And in those situations, you need to do what they actually have begun to do and pioneer in Northern Ireland to try to solve that dispute. And that is to work out forms of government in which sovereignty is restricted, is shared, is abridged, is breached. It's not thrown out the window in favor of love and peace for all. It's something far more complex, almost medieval in its complexity, but more promising and more fit for human habitation.
Let's turn to our callers. Nick is calling from Boston. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Oh, well, thank you. I do have, while an imperfect, a kind of a controversy and a controversial analogy, and that is focusing again on the Middle East and focusing on Israel, in a kind of microcosm, the use of a military power, which is overwhelming, analogous to the U.S. and the international environment over the Palestinians, it not only hasn't worked, it has generated a world reaction which is negative, and in a very subtle and destructive way, it's sowing the economic seeds of destruction of their entire country. Almost all of their, you know, economic might is being dedicated towards dealing ineffectively with more and more power, walls, and it's not solving their problem. And I think appropriately we are taking this enormously failed strategy on a national level and applying it internationally now soon to be doomed to exactly the same frustrations that the Israelis have.
Nick, let us pick it up, and thanks for your call. Jonathan Schell, what do you make of the example there? Terrible news out of Israel today. 16, maybe more dead in another terrorist attack on a bus there. Palestinians dead in a counterstrike by Israelis. But is the United States walking into a similar dynamic with the entire world is what Nick is suggesting here.
Well, first of all, you know, has the really the disgusting futility of violence and of force in a situation like that ever been more clearly demonstrated than in the damage that those two peoples are inflicting on one another? They can do it. They can do it to their heart's content. It's quite doable, and neither side can stop the other, as we see so clearly today. But does it get either of them anywhere? I dare say it does not. It's an exercise in futility, you know, taken to a kind of horrifying extreme.
But what about Nick's comparison of that kind of dynamic? And he's saying that Washington is now, you know, riding at large on the world.
I think we're in very serious danger of that. Look at what's happened in Iraq already. You know, between September 11th and the war in Iraq, the number of casualties in the United States from terrorism was zero. Zero. There was that guy who, the shoe bomber, so-called, he was the closest call, but he got caught, of those that we know about anyway. Now, we went into Iraq. Right away, we had 100 or so dead. Then, supposedly, the war ended. Since the war ended, we've had an average of about one American soldier killed every single day, as if we'd said to ourselves, they can't get us over here. Let's put some Americans in their midst over there and see if they can kill us. And they're doing just fine at it. And the whole idea that we can go there and impose our will, our conceptions, no matter how splendid or glorious those conceptions are, on that country, to me, is a monumental folly, and it does send us down. And we're already a few steps down that path that we do see in Israel and Palestine now.
Jack?
Well, I'm frightened by that as well, that parallel. I've mentioned it here. Our friend Robert Pape at the University of Chicago has a study coming out in the Political Science Quarterly of all the cases of suicide bombing in the world since, I think, 1979. And in every case, there have been other motives, there have been religious overlays, but in every case, the motive has been one to evict a foreign force from your territory. That seems to be the dynamic that pushes people to this desperate and despicable act. And to think that we began this whole cycle with a foreign force in Saudi Arabia, and now we're ending it with an army in Iraq.
There's progress.
Well, there we are. We're talking tonight about the limits of force and the pitfalls of empire with Jonathan Schell. His new book is The Unconquerable World. You can join the conversation. What is the alternative to the global policeman? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
9287.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the limits of force and the pitfalls of empire with author Jonathan Schell. He's joining us from New York tonight. His new book is The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. You can join the conversation as well. If the League of Nations failed, if the UN is looking peaked, what nonviolent international system might work? Is war outmoded, or is it an eternal fact of life? Is Jonathan Schell the true realist here? Or a dreamer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ed is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. Great show as always, and thanks for taking the call.
Good to have you.
You're taught in diplomacy school that the military power or military force is a very blunt instrument and always results in some degree of collateral damage, both physical, people, buildings, et cetera, but also in terms of knocking your country's prestige. And frankly, your own citizens actually begin to question your ability to be a leader if you're actually entering into a military situation where, frankly, you weren't attacked. And we have that situation here. And I'm wondering if you can all comment on the fact that, one, there was no aggressive action taken on the United States in the place we're in terms of Iraq, but also more directly, long-term, how can somebody actually keep this kind of momentum going for military conflict without having been attacked, and also keeping the American folks together enough to actually support those kinds of issues long run.
Ed, thanks for your call. Jonathan Schell, I guess the thing I'd be interested in hearing you go to in that is what you describe as the kind of corrosive impact on domestic politics, on democracy, on a republic when it reaches out militarily into the world. How do you see that dynamic?
Yes. You know, of course, there are the immediate financial costs of an empire. It's a hugely expensive thing. And by the way, the immense cost in tens of billions of dollars per year that will have to be expended in Iraq now for an indefinite future, think decades, not years, is something that's not mentioned much. But really, the ultimate cost, if it comes to that, can be something that's far more invaluable to us. And that is our constitutional system itself. Because once again, if you look back in history, starting with the Roman Empire, what you so very often have is that when a nation, a republican country, turns itself into an empire, the empire extinguishes the republic.
Why?
And that's, well, you know, Madison said that that the armies of Rome overmatched every competitor around the world, including finally the Roman Republic itself. In other words, you become militarized. You develop what Eisenhower, in a phrase that people have somehow forgotten, but he used it all the time. It's a very good phrase. I'm not referring to the military-industrial complex, which is well known, but he said garrison state, a garrison state. Already, I think we see the signs of that in the very serious erosions of civil liberties under the Patriot Act, with more coming under Patriot II, and equally serious was the breakdown of the system of checks and balances, which is really at the very heart of Republican government. You know, all the Congress needed was a sort of to hand over their sword to President Bush, almost as if it was a kind of ceremony in that resolution when they said, us wield the war power given us by the Constitution. No, thank you. We'll hand that off to the president.
So, Jonathan,
very severe distortion of the Constitution.
All that being the case, still, it's a tough world out there, and the threats are not distant. They can be. They have been very near. You write that the new conditions in the world offer, perhaps for the first time, you write, foundations for a new cooperative American foreign policy that is both thoroughly Republican and thoroughly engaged with the world. You're seeing this as a moment of opportunity? It seems like a moment of danger.
Well, certainly the dangers out there are very great. And when I speak of an opportunity, I'm thinking of something much deeper. Now, of course, a country should defend itself. But when it comes to dealing with the problems that exist on a global scale, such as the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, such as environmental degradation, economic problems, and so forth, you simply must have the cooperation of other nations. It's absolutely undoable otherwise. It's utopian, to use a charge that's thrown often in the other direction, to imagine that the United States can handle these problems unilaterally, alone, with force. That is what is fantastic, unreal.
So that's the downside. But where's the opportunity here? I mean, Europe has been depicted by George Bush's Washington as this kind of a morally slovenly continent, not prepared to step up and address the problems of the world, but just shove everything under the table and you know, have another glass of wine.
Well, you know, there is such a thing as a corruption of weakness as well as a corruption of strength. And I think one of the things that happened after the Cold War, I think the Europeans did unfortunately take too much of a backseat, did not step up to responsibilities in Bosnia, in their own backyard, and so forth. And the United States was kind of sucked into it. And I think that's part of what was what went on. And so I think together with a United States that is more cooperative, it will be actually better if we have a Europe that is more assertive. I actually welcome their assertiveness in the case of the Iraq War because, as you know, I think that war was a terrible mistake for the United States and the world. What we need is strong nations who cooperate, Cooperation shouldn't be something for the weak. Cooperation should be done through a kind of overflow of strength and confidence. I would agree with you that that the Europeans would do well to step forward more boldly and with greater strength in the world.
Sarah's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. What an important program. I have just a couple of things to say. And the first is that the world is weary of war. Look at the reaction of Europe and the rest of the world to our getting excited over Iraq.
It's pretty plain, isn't it?
Before we even went. Mm-hmm. We saw how Europe knows all about war. They've had nothing but wars with each other since the time of Rome. And look how Rome fell. Americans really don't want to be an empire. We don't feel like that. We're like everyone in the world. We want to live in peace. We want to do our lives. And why shouldn't everyone be able to do their lives?
And yet, Sarah, of course, war weariness is not enough to bring something else into play.
Well, the something else to bring in is what Gandhi and Martin Luther King taught us, nonviolence. You can get your goals with nonviolence. They did. They gave their lives for it, but they were forerunners. We're now ready for this.
We're now ready for it. Sarah, thanks for your call and for your observations. Jonathan Schell, we've just got a couple minutes left here. Is the world ready for this? And given the posture that we're in today, what's the path from this moment in time and circumstance to the kind of future you're describing, Sarah's describing?
Well, I like the drift of the of Sarah's comments. Let me further note that the accomplishment in Europe of putting to rest many centuries of conflict is once again, you know, we use the word nonviolence. It's an unfortunate phrase in a way, because what we're talking about is something hugely energetic and positive. And that's something, by the way, that Gandhi insisted upon. It's not something that's pale and that's just sort of a negation of something else. And indeed, what the Europeans have done, especially Germany and France, when they forged right after the Second World War, an economic relationship in coal and steel that was specifically designed to wed them together so tightly that a war between them would again become unthinkable. And the European Union, which is really an astonishing experiment in political federalism, really without any parallel in the history of the world, is an immense achievement for peace, and if you want to put it that way, of nonviolence, because it was done without violence. But as I say, we need more positive words for this.
And Jonathan Schell, we're going to have you back to figure out the path ahead. We've got your critique. The path ahead's still a little murky to me, but we get the drift, and we appreciate it. Thanks for joining us tonight.
I've got a lot to say about that other thing. I'm sorry time ran out.
So am I, but we'll have you back. Jonathan Schell is author of the new book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. Jack Beatty, just a few seconds, but there's a critique that says, whoa.
Yes, and to find in this war hope, to find in the world's response to it a thread of hope to a better world. That is something I think we need to hear more about.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, seeking the truth behind the genocide in Rwanda. This is On Point. Rwandan playwright Jean-Marie Kayashima says the genocide in his nation was all the result of lies. A man couldn't kill his neighbor if somewhere there was not a lie, he says. Kayashima tried to dispel some of those lies during his nation's long civil war by writing historical dramas about Rwanda from nearby Burundi, where he was in exile. In total, the playwright spent 37 years in exile, finally returning home to Rwanda just 6 months ago. Kayashima is one of four writers from international conflict zones who have been traveling the country since April, reading from their works as part of a program directed by the William Joyner Center for the Study of War and Social Consequences at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Here, Kayashima reads an excerpt from his soon-to-be-published play, Truth Only. You will hear his reading in French with an English translation. The scene features a militia commander and a soldier who had fought on opposite sides during Rwanda's civil war. both of whom have been condemned to death for their atrocities. The scene begins with the militia commander having a nightmare.
Soldier, what's wrong, militia commander? You're waking the dead. Militia commander, just the opposite, you could have said. It's the dead who wake me. It's the girl. Soldier, easy to guess. You killed her, right? Militia commander, yes. She was so beautiful. Beautiful as a diamond drop of water in the chalice of a frond. Beautiful beyond words. An impossible beauty. She rushed in front of me out of nowhere, sprinting, skirt held up, disheveled, breathless, and threw herself at my feet. She entwined her two arms around my legs and her pursuers stopped. I was their boss. Then her face rose slowly towards me, and then I saw her eyes, two eyes bigger than any I had ever seen. Such terror mixed with such charm. Oh, Lord. Soldier, and? Militia commander, her eyes, soldier, the depth of her eyes. Looking into them, vertigo overcame me. Exactly like when you stand on the edge of a steep cliff. She cried silently. Her tears came like a small stream of water running down her cheeks and then her neck, then further down, forcing themselves into the furrow formed by her two exquisite breasts. She wore a slightly low-cut blouse, and you could see she had no bra. And her adolescent breasts pointed towards me like loaded weapons. Soldier, what a comparison. Militia commander, I know what I'm saying. It was true aggression. My whole being was in turmoil. I didn't know where I was or what I did. And to top it off, her lower lip began to tremble, uncovering the coral of a perfect set of teeth, and a hesitant tear clung to the edge of a long eyelash. It was evening. The setting sun glanced obliquely on the teardrop and turned it iridescent. I was lost. Everything was in turmoil inside me, a thousand looks around me, which I no longer saw but knew to be there, fixed on me. All my certainty, my hate, my ambition, my love even was floating, brought by and drowned in a teardrop, a simple tear soldier, trembling on a feminine eyelash. Too much. It was too much. It was that woman or me, and it was necessary to act quickly. I didn't even take the decision. A sort of profound wave submerged me, and I took by feel the closest machete out of the hands of a militiaman. And I struck. I struck like a woodcutter to kill myself. Soldier? Yes? Militia commander. It wasn't a slip. It's so hard to cut the last thread attaching a criminal to the rest of humanity.
Rwandan playwright Jean-Marie Kagoshima reading from his soon-to-be-published play, Truth Only. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is